Rebecca Tapscott is an Ambizione Research Fellow at the Albert Hirschman Center on Democracy. In July 2021, she published her new book, Arbitrary States, Social Control and Modern Authoritarianism in Museveni's Uganda. The book asks the essential question, how do authoritarian regimes survive in contexts of democratic institutions, however imperfect or partial? To reflect on her fieldwork in Uganda, and particularly her experiences with fear and empathy in the field, she is joined by Anastasia Cesterinina, lecturer in politics at Sheffield University. Together, they will explore the challenges of field-intensive research on contemporary armed conflict and states in transition on this episode of Research at the Albert Hirschman Center on Democracy.
Congratulations on the book, Rebecca. This is really exciting. I very much look forward to reading it. To start our conversation, I'd like to learn a little bit about how you did your research. Where did you go? How did you carry out your fieldwork?
Thank you so much. And I just, you know, wanted to add, I'm really happy to have you here today and to be in conversation with you, because especially your work on research ethics in conflict settings has been really influential in my thinking on this. So I'm really happy to be having this conversation. And so the majority of my research was in northern Uganda, which is a context that is really highly conflict affected. So there was almost a 2-decade-long insurgency there between the Lord's Resistance Army and the government of Uganda that really devastated social, economic, and political life. I also did some research in other parts of the country that also have their own particular histories of political violence as well. And also, you know, the country has sort of become increasingly authoritarian over the past several decades, even since I started my research in 2014. And so the research that I did was with informal security actors like vigilantes, militias, and community policing initiatives. And I looked at these actors as a lens to try to understand how violence is institutionalized by state security services. And in particular, these sort of informal violent actors can be a really helpful lens to try to understand these dynamics, because they sit at and also kind of trouble distinctions between legal and illegal and formal, informal, and also constructive and corrosive. And so in practice, what this really meant is that I interviewed mainly these kind of under and unemployed young men who acted as sort of first responders to often petty crime, but also to more sort of serious local level concerns like fighting, domestic violence, livestock theft, and even over sort of local social issues like sanitary conditions. So between 2014 and 2018, over 10 months in the field, I conducted approximately 350 semi-structured and unstructured interviews.
This certainly resonates with the research that I have done, Rebecca. We have both worked in settings of protracted conflict. We've both paid close attention to subnational variation, and our respondents were almost highly marginal individuals who have participated in sensitive processes of conflict. And I really kind of appreciated your focus on semi-structured and unstructured interviews, which also resonates quite a lot. And through this kind of work, what I had realized is that our own experience of interviewing greatly impacts the dynamic of the interviews, but also the research results. And in particular, I have developed kind of a strong understanding of the effect of empathy and fear on how we do our work, on the nature of conversations that we have on highly sensitive issues in areas marked by conflict and violence. Do you find that your fear also shaped your research process?
Yeah, I mean, again, this is one of the reasons that your work really spoke to me, is because of some similarities in the populations that we're studying, and indeed kind of this discussion of this emotional register that you have when you research people. Fear certainly was in some ways something that came up, but I would actually say even more so for me, a better word might be sort of skepticism or doubt, or even kind of a mutual suspicion at times. And, you know, there are often sort of questions about why an American might be so interested in the minutiae of local security, and also questions about, you know, sort of if I really was who I said I was. And this is also, you know, a really highly saturated research environment in northern Uganda, in particular because of kind of this post-conflict humanitarian context. In my first phases of research, people would often ask me, ma'am, if you're a researcher, you know, where's your survey? So this sort of register of suspicion, I think, reflects aspects of how the state actually structures social relations amongst people. There's this really pervasive feeling that you don't know who you're talking to or who might be a threat to you, or even more so, you know, how these relationships might change over time. So from reading your work, I thought, you know, it's also really interesting to think about this sort of wide array of emotional registers in addition to fear that might be more or less relevant to different kinds of research environments.
Absolutely. I found quite strong examples of suspicion in my research, particularly actually with security agents. So individuals involved in the de facto APAS security apparatus. And that's where that emotion was the strongest. But I also found that the ways in which I entered the field through gatekeepers who were local leaders in various communities helped probably dissipate some of that suspicion with the ordinary people that I worked with. And one of the interesting findings from this research was that, of course, I didn't fear everyone I had spoken with. I had learned later when kind of unpacking what happened during my fieldwork that fear was particularly experienced with those individuals who continued their violent activities into the period of my fieldwork, whereas those who had participated in a distant war, particularly because of the various dilemmas that they faced, those individuals I didn't fear. Instead, I actually surprisingly developed empathy toward these individuals, which I then came to understand as embracing the other's meaning, which of course other scholars have suggested that we can do even if we do not agree with or are repelled by what is being said. So how did you deal with situations where you were quote unquote repelled or in fundamental ways disagreed with your interlocutors?
I think it was actually really rare that I felt sort of repelled by my respondents. Going back to your piece and thinking about it, I was sort of considering, you know, why might this be? Since a lot of my discussions were about violence, often extra-legal violence that, you know, I certainly don't agree with or wish it happened, right? And I'm still not sure what the answer to that is. But I wonder if maybe it's because I was studying violence in particular in terms of how it creates social order, sort of as part of a policing and governing people. It really sort of emphasized how every choice was embedded in a set of other choices made under really significant institutional constraints in which sort of public and private interests are really woven together and difficult to disentangle. For instance, I interviewed dozens of young men about why they decided to join these sort of politicized informal policing groups, sometimes referred to even as militias. And this was in some ways on its face really distasteful. They were volunteering to contribute to a broadly repressive political environment. At the same time, this is a context where the economy is really heavily politicized and securitized. So for these young men who are extremely precariously employed, the demands to collect school fees, pay hospital bills, and put food on the table can make joining these initiatives seem like the best option, and sometimes even the only option. And the intensity of this, I felt, was really palpable. I remember in one of my early interviews, I talked to a group of young vigilantes who were sort of sitting around criticizing the police as corrupt, arbitrarily violent, and useless on the one hand, only to tell me just a couple of minutes later that they would jump at any opportunity to join the police force. And so here's a world in which there really aren't two sides, but everyone is actually drawn into this system, becoming their own sort of keepers, or what I describe in the book as kind of self-policing.
You mentioned that every choice was embedded in a range of other choices, and that was a very powerful statement in my view. And I would add that these kinds of choices are not only embedded in a complex system of decision-making, but also in really complex social settings and histories of conflict. And this is certainly something that resonates with my own work, where I found that quite surprisingly often individuals decided to join the fighting, persuaded by their friendship networks, by their kin, whereas others whom I would have expected to join, for instance, highly politicized activists from the pre-war period, similarly persuaded by their families, fled to protect themselves. And of course, that brings us to a difficult question of how do we conduct this kind of research? How do we interview people whose worldviews are fundamentally different, whose experiences shock us, and whose stories we find really difficult to process?
And I think in the context of Uganda, these questions were in some ways potentially even further amplified because of this real fluidity around distinctions that I otherwise might see as kind of central to my own normative judgments. And so, for instance, in interviews with the police, they often express that they were between sort of a rock and a hard place. They're sort of seen as bad guys by foreign researchers, but they saw themselves as the steward of an unwieldy society. And I recall one police officer sort of saying to me that when one institution fails, we have to step in. We won't allow the country to appear stateless. So there were also times when it was really apparent that my respondents didn't particularly care how much I took their side or empathized with them. You know, some respondents, of course, sort of wanted to engage me personally and even became good friends. So I think reflecting this aspect of empathy described in your paper. But others encountered me as a foreign white woman whose presence might be leveraged to imply their importance or international connections to some other audience. Where other people saw me and my project in the context of their own responsibilities, someone who they should sort of either help or hinder as part of their duties or perhaps responsibilities to higher authorities.
Yeah, these power dynamics in the field are quite stark. I think that we have a lot of knowledge also to draw on in the emerging field of fieldwork ethics and conflict areas to continue our conversation on this. But I also think that sometimes we cannot embrace others' views. Sometimes we do become friends and develop other kinds of relationships where empathy actually is the foundation of a relationship and trust. Other times we will be faced with situations where no matter how much empathy we develop, we cannot quite ask those difficult questions and follow up probes. And this is something that Leanne Fuji, in her most recent book called Working Relationships, we have to establish these working relationships with individuals we work with, particularly in these sensitive settings, which might be a guideline for us to kind of accept these both limitations of our own emotional capacity, but also the different ways in which we will be perceived by the respondents with whom we work. But of course, when it comes to really difficult settings, such as the ones that you're describing and the ones that I have worked in, we worry quite a lot about our own safety, but also, of course, the safety of our research participants. So how did you approach this kind of a worry in your work in Uganda?
So in Uganda, you have lots of scholars and even journalists or public figures who are writing really salient and very critical material about the Ugandan government, which sort of suggests that it's actually not that risky. But at the same time, I definitely felt a lot of anxiety about my own research, about potentially appearing critical of the government, and also what this might mean for my respondents. In terms of risk to respondents, this experience really highlighted that the research environment is always changing, and it's really unpredictable what will happen in the future. So it's really important to take significant precautions, and perhaps at times even seemingly sort of overcautious given what things look like at the moment. And I was really struck that if even I, in my privileged position as an outsider with access to international networks, can feel this anxiety so intensely, it must be a very effective way of kind of quashing open and free speech. And so this led me to really try to understand fear and anxiety analytically in addition to empirically, and has caused me to think a lot about how these emotional registers are produced as well as their political effects.
Yes, yeah, certainly. This is something that in another work, Leanne Fuji called an ongoing responsibility that we have. And of course, these changing conditions on the ground have been highlighted by a range of scholars from Elizabeth Wood to Sarah Parkinson, Gillian Schwedler, etc., myself including, and particularly highlighted with regards to conversations about transparency in qualitative mixed methods research. So as part of the qualitative transparency deliberations of the American Political Science Association qualitative and multi-methods section, this was probably one of the key takeaway points. And this is something that I think it would be very important to end our conversation on, given that we have focused so much on the ethics of this work, the fact that we have an ongoing responsibility throughout the lifespan of our project, from the research design all the way to publication, something that I'm sure you've upholded, and it's something that I'm sure future research will greatly benefit from.
For more on these themes, Please join us on October 5th at 6:30 p.m. for a hybrid panel discussion that marks the launch of Rebecca's book in the context of the 2021 edition of the Geneva Democracy Week, or head to the links in the show notes.